1914, 50 years ago, the year of the Great Divide. In the peaceful first months of 1914, Gustav Holst was composing his orchestral suite, The Planets. Its opening movement he called Mars. In writing music full of the menace of modern war, one might almost think that Holst had been possessed by a premonition. If this was so, he was an exceptional man. There were very few people early in 1914 who had any foreboding of what was to come. As we look back across the Great Divide, we see over there on the other side the people of 1914 standing unapprehensive and unconcerned because they'd never had experience of total war. What a comfortable, easy-going feeling there is about these tunes. But then these were, in many ways, comfortable times. The British were the richest trading nation in the world. Sitting complacently on our little island, drinking our beer at tuppence a pint, we lived comfortably behind the greatest navy the world had ever seen. We felt safe. We didn't expect war.
And Germany. Germany was building dreadnoughts in a desperate bid to overtake the British Navy. In Germany, in France, in Russia, in Austria, vast armies were standing poised. The nations feared one another. Yet the common people of Europe didn't expect war. They believed that peace was guaranteed by their great armies and navies, by what they called the balance of power.
It seemed a peaceful world, a smiling world, a safe world. In the year's first months, people were not particularly concerned with armies and navies. They had other things to think about. Let us call in the evidence of a teenager of the time. He was a 19-year-old lad from Yorkshire, J.B. Priestley.
In the summer of 1914, with my luggage on my back and my savings in my pocket, I set out on a walking tour of the Rhine. I'd bought and smoked one of those yard-long German pipes, still in common use then. I stayed in tiny German inns. I strummed on pianos for peasant tenors and basses who put down pipes even larger than mine, and we called for more rounds of wine and beer. I had a roaring good time in a world which was ending.
And a new world beginning, if anyone noticed it.
Mr. W. R. Morris, the Oxford garage proprietor, announces that he is now building his motor cars at the extraordinary rate of 350 a year.
350, the start of mass production, the beginning of the motor age.
This car, with 10 horsepower engine, hood, and acetylene headlamps, sells at £175. Mr. Morris's slogan for it is 50 miles an hour, 50 miles a gallon.
At £175, a motor car was far beyond my pocket in Bradford. I was working as a junior clerk in a wool office at 15 shillings a week. Motor cars were only for the rich. The streets were still thronged with horse traffic. Although we were living in the 20th century, in some ways the 19th was still with us. In every town and village, the horse ran alongside the motor. And now a new thing called the flying machine was making the headlines.
April the 21st, 1914. Today, while King George V and Queen Mary were crossing the Channel in the royal yacht, en route to Paris to celebrate 10 years of the Entente Cordiale, a cinematograph camera made history by taking pictures from a flying machine overhead.
While the picture palace, as we called it, was the new diversion, the old music hall was still most people's chief place of entertainment. I was especially fond of the fourpenny balcony at the Bradford Empire, where you looked down through a blue haze of smoke onto a boisterous stage, and you sang.
Oh, Chandler!
It was a good town then. Yes, and a musical town. The Halle Orchestra came regularly, and there were chamber concerts, and once for ninepence I heard trios played by Kreisler, Casals, and Bauer. Despite the very long hours we worked at the office, we youngsters did pack a lot of other things into life on top of work. We argued for hours in pubs and cafes. We went long walks over the moors. We did a lot of singing in slapdash style in the front room at home. Once I earned a guinea singing noisy comic songs at a Saturday night concert at the Mechanics Institute. The impresario, a seedy old pro, billed me as Jack Crowley of the leading London and provincial halls. On another night, of all the new exciting things that were crowding into our lives, the most urgent hit me when I went over to Leeds to a variety show at the Empire and heard ragtime. Suddenly, I discovered the 20th century glaring and screaming at me.
Oh, every evening here in Sing, it's the cutest little thing. Got the cutest little swing. Hitch-a-goo, hitch-a-goo, hitch-a-goo.
The syncopated frenzy of this was something quite new. Shining with sweat, the ragtimers almost hung over the footlights, defying us to resist the rhythm and drumming us into another kind of life in which anything might happen.
Oh, every evening here in Sing, it's the cutest little thing. Got the cutest little swing. Hitch-a-goo, hitch-a-goo.
I believe that the popular song can be prophetic. It can suddenly reveal great and terrible events to come. Out of this ragtime came fragmentary outlines of a menace to old Europe, the domination of America, the emergence of Africa, the end of confidence and any feeling of security, the nervous excitement, the frenzy of modern times.
Oh, every evening here in Sing, it's the cutest little thing. Got the cutest little swing. Hitch-a-goo, hitch-a-goo.
Ragtime, the pop music of 1914. There was something else that gave us a taste of the up-to-date, a foretaste of the future, and that was the aeroplane. But flying was nothing but a sport. Races, stunts, looping-the-loop demonstrations, indulged in by dashing young madmen such as Claude Graham White.
People at that time regarded a flying machine as unlikely to be of any use in war, or indeed to influence in any way the future of transport. Nevertheless, I built many aeroplanes, including the Graham White Flying Charabanc, with which I announced that I would take up 7 passengers. The flight was successfully made at Hendon, not with 7, but with 9 passengers. It's true that some of the passengers were simply perched on the wings. There wasn't room for them all in the cockpit. But they went up and they came down safely. We also made the first parachute descent from an aeroplane in flight. Mr. Newell, the chap who dropped, didn't have his parachute strapped on his back as they do nowadays, but simply folded it up on his knee haphazard. He sat on the undercarriage, and at 3,000 feet, he was shoved off with a hefty kick from behind. It sounds amusing now, but it was a very, very anxious time for us just then.
While the flying men were dropping a sensational parachute, Bernard Shaw was dropping a deliberate and equally sensational brick in the London theatre. His new play, Pygmalion, opened at His Majesty's Theatre, and the critic of the Daily News wrote of it,
"This is an amusing skit on the thinness of the partition that divides good from bad manners. The audacity of Liza's use of a sanguinary adjective came as a bombshell on the first night of Pygmalion."
Goodbye, Colonel Pickering.
Goodbye, Miss Doolittle.
Goodbye, all.
Are you walking across the park, Miss Doolittle? If so...
Walk? Not bloody likely.
Sensation in the theatre. As an elder character in the play said, "I really can't get used to the young ways." Youth was being so scandalous. There was the new tango in the ballrooms. There were even tango teas.
And the disrespectful, exuberant, satirical, ragtimey revues, which were sweeping the lighter London stage.
Miss Phyllis Monkman, principal dancer at the London Alhambra.
The show was a revue called Keep Smiling, and we were supposed to be the gayest of the gay. The stalls were always packed with young men in white ties and tails. One of these Piccadilly Johnnies was reputed to have booked his seat for the whole run of the show. From the stage, a gangplank projected over the orchestra pit, and along this the girls would parade while Johnny's eyes goggled. I never had wine drunk from my slipper, but I did find jewels hidden in baskets of flowers which were left at the stage door. Although I was principal dancer, and although I was over 16, someone from home always came to collect me at the end of the show. This no doubt sounds protective and paternal, but that's how it was. The stage door Johnnies just had to wait.
I'm Gilbert the Filbert, the nut with a K, the pride of Piccadilly, the blasé roué. Oh, Hades, the ladies who leave their wooden hats for Gilbert the Filbert, the colonel of the nuts.
Gilbert the Filbert, the nut with a K, the pride of Piccadilly,
the blasé roué. Oh, Hades, the ladies who leave their wooden hats for Gilbert the Filbert, the colonel of the nuts.
Early in 1914, we who were young weren't in the least troubled by war or fears of war. There may have been international tensions in Europe. If there were, we just didn't notice. We weren't crisis-prone in those days. No tensions for us, no troubles. A lovely time to be young in.
But of course, that golden age, that golden sovereign age, had its less giddy and genial features.
Things like slums, terrible, disgraceful slums, and suffragettes shouting, "Votes for women." I'm ashamed to say we didn't pay much serious attention to them. No, we just thought them very, very silly.
In the first 7 months of 1914, the suffragettes did more destruction than in any previous year and got more headlines.
Suffragette outrage in the National Gallery. The Rokeby Venus mutilated.
Mrs. Pankhurst arrested outside Buckingham Palace.
Three Scottish castles burned down.
Bombs found in Westminster Abbey.
The newspapers seemed to pay more attention to the militant exploits of these ladies in Britain than to any threatening military situation in Europe. Only a very few people were apprehensive of that. Our Victorian fathers had passed on to us the gospel of the inevitable progress of mankind, upward, ever upward to utopia. So, of course, in the dawning days of the aeroplane and the motor car, we never suspected that the fairy godmother could be anything but a good fairy. At least, hardly any of us. There was a novelist named H.G. Wells.
Mr. H.G. Wells publishes in 1914 a novel called The World Set Free, a piece of science fiction in which he looks into the future. Wells predicts that in 40 years' time, by 1954, men will have invented an atom-driven engine, replacing all old means of power. The atom will be used even to drive flying machines. And then will come what Wells, in 1914, amazingly calls the atomic bomb. He writes of an aviator dropping the first one.
He hoisted the bomb over the side. It fell, a great ball of crimson-purple fire. It was like looking down upon the crater of a small volcano.
This book was not one of H.G. Wells' bestsellers. It was too far-fetched. It was too unreal. The atomic bomb that Wells foresaw in this novel, his prophetic vision of anarchy in Europe, seemed utterly incredible to a people enjoying a sense of security born of a long period of peace and prosperity. The people of 1914, who believed that peace was guaranteed by great armies and navies.
In the high summer of 1914, the British and German navies meet in spectacular and peaceful fraternization. It is June. A squadron of British battleships sails to Germany and attends Kiel Yachting Week by invitation of His Imperial Majesty Kaiser Wilhelm.
A personal memoir of the event by Admiral Sir William Goodenough, at that time captain of HMS Southampton.
The Kaiser, when visiting the British flagship, wore the uniform of a British Admiral of the Fleet and said, with that somewhat exaggerated phrase of speech to which he was addicted, that he was proud to wear the uniform worn by Lord Nelson. His brother, Prince Henry, an Honorary Admiral in our own fleet, said, "This is what I have long hoped for, to see a portion of the British and German fleets laying side by side in friendship in Kiel Harbour." The feeling between the more senior officers was friendly, if rather dispassionate. With the more junior officers, the fraternization appeared to be complete. Their private homes were open to such of our officers who cared to go and see them, their clubs, their day and night amusements. All were friendly. Then came the blow. The Kaiser was out in his racing yacht and was hastily recalled to be told that his great personal friend, the Archduke Ferdinand of Austria, lay murdered at Sarajevo.
Sarajevo, June the 28th, 1914. The Archduke Ferdinand, heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, friend and ally of the German Kaiser, assassinated by Serbian patriots.
Sarajevo. To us, the ordinary people at home in Britain, it was some unheard-of place, a long way away in what is now Yugoslavia. We glanced at the headline and passed it by. It was a glorious summer, that summer of 1914.
The Pierrots in their pom-pom costumes were singing a song by the glittering sea. A song about motor cars.
He'd have to get under.
Get out and get under.
Then he'd get back at the wheel. A dozen times they'd start to hug and kiss, and then the down-down engine it would miss, and then he'd have to get under.
Get out and get under and fix up his automobile.
Straw-hatted, carefree, we took our deck chairs down to the beach. We had our daily dose of excitement in the newspapers, but not from Sarajevo.
The crisis in Ireland. Britain on verge of civil war.
Were we? Civil war? Could this be true? Mr. Asquith's government in London was proposing to enact Home Rule for Ireland, but the Irishmen themselves were so passionately divided over this issue, the Ulstermen on one side, the Southerners on the other, that fighting seemed bound to begin. Private armies were drilling openly in the Irish meadows. Thousands of boxes of rifles were landed on the Irish coast.
July the 24th. The British cabinet met today at 10 Downing Street.
All afternoon, the cabinet strove to find a solution to the trouble in Ireland. Tired and undecided, the meeting was breaking up when the Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, began quietly reading a document that had come in from the Foreign Office. It was an ultimatum from Austria to Serbia. The assassination at Sarajevo had set the alarm bells ringing.
July 1914. The Russian Imperial Ballet performs in London for the last time.
Production by Serge Diaghilev.
The Russian Imperial Ballet in Prince Igor.
Never had there been such a spectacular year of opera. while Caruso and Melba sang at Covent Garden, Sir Joseph Beecham's season was a sensation over at Drury Lane. He'd brought to London the ballet of the Russian Imperial Opera House, and with a splendid company of singers, headed by Shaliapin, he wedded opera and ballet in a manner never seen in England before. I leave with you this last picture of the days of richness. In the audience, all the glittering wealth and culture of London society, while across the stage swirl the dancers from the Tsar's Opera House in Moscow.
July the 29th, Austrian guns bombard Belgrade.
July the 30th, Russia mobilizes her troops.
August the 1st, Germany declares war on Russia.
Mobilization ordered in France.
France asks Britain for an assurance of her support. But in London, the House of Commons meets for a debate on the Irish crisis.
A memoir by the Countess of Oxford and Asquith.
My husband, the Prime Minister, got up and announced that he did not intend to speak on the Irish motion. We meet, he said, under conditions of gravity which are almost unparalleled in the experience of every one of us. The issues of peace and war are hanging in the balance. In these circumstances, he appealed to the House not to enter into an acute controversy in regard to domestic differences. When my husband sat down, there was gravity and bewilderment on every face. I got up to leave the gallery, but the earnest Ulster ladies crowded round me. Good heavens, Margot, they cried, what can all this mean? How fearfully dangerous. Don't you realize the Irish were fighting each other this very night? Answering as if in a dream, I said, we are on the verge of a European war.
That was on the Friday before the August bank holiday. All that weekend, the British government was sending cables to Germany. It was feared that she would attack France through Belgium.
As dusk fell on the Sunday evening, a friend called to see Sir Edward Grey at the Foreign Office. The lamplighters were going through the streets outside. The Foreign Secretary, standing in the window, said, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime."
On Tuesday, August the 4th, Parliament met. The Prime Minister announced that the government had asked Germany for an assurance not to invade Belgium. A satisfactory reply must be given by midnight, German time.
A satisfactory reply by midnight. Those fateful and terrible words were greeted by wave upon wave of cheering, which continued and increased as my husband walked slowly down the floor of the House, faced the Speaker, and announced that he had a message from the King.
By His Majesty the King, a proclamation declaring a state of emergency and calling out the army reserves.
When the Speaker had finished, all the members poured out the House. I left the gallery and went down to the Prime Minister's room. Henry was sitting at the writing table. He looked grave. I walked to the window. For some time, neither of us spoke. Then I went and stood behind his chair. "So it's all up," I said. "Yes," he answered. "It's all up."
British Admiralty to His Majesty's ships, August the 4th, 2:05 p.m. British ultimatum to Germany will expire at midnight. No act of war should be committed before that hour, at which time telegram to commence hostilities against Germany will be dispatched from Admiralty.
After dinner, I joined my husband, Lord Crewe, and Sir Edward Grey in the cabinet room. The night was hot. The windows were all open. We sat without speaking and listen to the distant sound of thousands and thousands of people singing and cheering outside the railings of Buckingham Palace. Other members of the cabinet came into the room. We sat in silence, while a clock on the mantelpiece ticked out the hours. Then Big Ben struck. The crowd outside seemed to be singing and cheering everywhere. But inside the cabinet room, it was silent as dawn. I left to go to bed. No reply from Germany. We were at war.
Admiralty to all ships. Commence hostilities against Germany.
That night at the Alhambra Theatre, as we were in the middle of the show, dashing young men climbed up from their seats in the stalls onto the stage, and we all sang and danced together, young men and girls. How strange it is to think that here we were on the verge of the world's greatest war, and we cheered and laughed and cheered like mad.
Next morning brought another hot day, and the holiday crowds went down to the seashore and read about a world catastrophe. But what meaning had that for people born and bred in a safe and tranquil civilization? The townsman went on with his job, and in the drowsy fields, the harvesters were soon gathering the corn.